This is your first American interview ever, right?
Yes, that is correct.
There you go. So we're making history here, folks. My win, we boss,
love my win. There's a distinct lack of information coming from South Africa, not because there's a lack of events. What's happening in America, what's happening in other countries, it's happening in South Africa as well. How it's being done, how it's being coordinated, we just don't know. As far as I know, and this is typical of South Africans, I suppose, and possibly everywhere else, is when we gave the craft and the bodies to the to you guys, we only gave you two bodies. we kept one, and there has been independent corroboration of people who was contracted to assist the military in doing an autopsy on this being at one of our world famous hospitals in Cape Town.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 3. It is February 17th, 2008. And we're coming at you a little bit later than usual. I want to apologize for that. It's just been a bit of a crazy week and weekend here at the BOA HQ. A lot of family drama on the home front. Never seems to end here for me, folks. I don't know what's going on. But we're here with a really, really cool edition of the show. Really promising episode. Very ambitious installment of BOA Audio. As many longtime listeners know, I love the international coverage. I love to talk about stuff going on around the world as far as esoterica goes. And I really wanted to challenge myself here as Season 3 picked up again in 2008 to find more and more international guests and cover areas that haven't been discussed anywhere else on any esoteric radio programs. And I'm happy to say that we're going to be doing that here this week as we're going to call nearly 8,000 miles away to Cape Town, South Africa, for the first ever American interview by Christo Lowe, head of South Africa's UFO resource, known as SAUFOR. We are going to dig into the South African UFO field from top to bottom. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about key cases in South Africa, like a 1989 UFO shootdown over Botswana, plus just tons and tons and tons of amazing UFO stories from South Africa over the last century or so. We're also going to talk about famous South African contactees, the history of UFO studies in South Africa, how it compares and contrasts to American ufology. The big picture influences on the field are the same there as they are here. The government, the military, the media, how do they shape the UFO culture in South Africa? We're going to find out from someone who knows best, the head of the South African UFO resource, Christo Lowe, coming at us direct from Cape Town, South Africa. 7-hour difference on this one, my friends. Like I said, 8,000 miles. It was quite a mind-blowing episode to tape. Christo was up in the morning. I was up about 1 o'clock in the morning, my time, trying to tape the interview. So I'm a little bit rough around the edges at certain points during the show because it was getting pretty late in the evening and luckily for Christo, it was early in the morning for him, but I was getting a little worn out. But needless to say, it is a tremendously educational edition of BOA Audio featuring tons of international UFO material that I'm willing to bet you've never heard before because, as I said, this is Christo's first ever American interview. And we're going to be looking at ufology from a continent that is just way too often overlooked in the global UFO picture. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Christo Lowe, let me give you a little bit of background on him. Christo Lowe hails from Cape Town, South Africa. He has been interested in all things celestial since he was a child, and is one of the few South Africans who can legitimately claim to be a UFO expert. He is the country's only full-time dedicated UFO researcher, and heads the South African UFO resource organization known as SAUFOR. He has spent the last 5 years compiling a database of key South African UFO cases, and working with his group, SAUFOR, to raise awareness of the UFO issue to the South African people. His website is www.saufor.com, SAUFOR.com. Without any further ado, let's head on down to Cape Town, South Africa, and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on January 25th, 2008. Christo Lowe, talking about South African ufology on BOA Audio Season 3.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very, very special edition of Been All of America Audio. We are going all the way to South Africa, my friends. 7 hours difference. It's 8 in the morning down there. It's 1 a.m. here, but we're going to rock and roll. We're going to be delving into the South African UFO scene. For many of the listeners here in America who are listening to the program, they probably barely know anything about the South African UFO scene. I didn't really know much until I started doing research for the interview, so I was really psyched to be able to track down Christo Lowe. He is South Africa's only dedicated UFO researcher and heads the South African UFO Resource, SAUFOR. You can find out more about the South African UFO Resource at www.saufor.com. Coming at us all the way from Cape Town, South Africa, Christo Lowe, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tim, and all your listeners. I'm looking very much forward to sharing a bit of our point of view as we see it from down south in the continent of Africa.
Awesome, I can't wait. And of course, this is your first American interview ever, right? Your first appearance ever on an American radio show or podcast or whatever, right?
Yes, that is correct.
There you go. So we're making history here, folks. We're breaking down boundaries. We're crossing continents. We're doing time zone differences. It's wild here, but I can't wait to dig in. Christo, let's start out with, you know, the thumbnail beginning, the bio, the background. Who is Christo Lowe? How did you find an interest in the UFO phenomenon? And while you're framing your background, give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch on South Africa for the people here in the United States who maybe are a little xenophobic and don't know much beyond their own hometown or something. Tell us a little bit about South Africa. Tell us a little bit about Christo Lowe and how you gravitated towards the UFO subject.
Okay, where do I begin with South Africa's bio? yes, it's a very, very mixed cultural background country. We've got 11 official languages in this country. Most people, if they think about South Africa, they would most probably relate it to a term called apartheid, which is something that was a political situation that led up until about 1993. And in 1994, a new president came in called Nelson Mandela. He was incarcerated in one of our most famous prisons for a very long period as a political prisoner. But when he became president, a lot of things changed. Something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission came into being, and a lot of past issues came to the fore, and a lot more transparency in terms from of the government became available and was focused on. Personally, I believe that South Africa is one of the most beautiful countries in the world. I especially love Cape Town, the city where I'm staying at, and especially the mix of the people, the different cultural backgrounds, the different religions, points of views. It's just the most amazing place to discover yourself and to get a bit of a picture of possibly what the universe could be looking like out there. With all the different possible extraterrestrial races and such other beings. Mm-hmm. Now, who am I? How did I get involved in the UFO scene? As far as I can remember, I've been a bit of a bookworm, and I was always reading books on the unexplained and the mysterious. We used to get these Reader's Digest compendiums of the unexplained, and I remember the first UFO information I came across was in books like that. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 12 years old, I read my first book where a lot of attention was given to UFO experiences and sightings in South Africa. This was written by an author called Cynthia Hind. She was a national coordinator for MUFON in Africa. And she has since passed on, but she has managed to write two books on the subject, and she also gave quite a few talks at international conferences, so she was quite well known. And I must just take my hat off for the pioneering work that she did.
Yeah.
Then for me, I started talking about UFOs, you know, after having read her book and, you know, wondering why people aren't talking about this very, very interesting subject and all things related to it. And then as I started talking to people, I realized why people weren't talking. Because I'll tell you what's happened, Tim, is that it would seem that people, most people have got quite a very strong opinion about UFOs, about extraterrestrials, about all these, you know, fringe subjects, although it's not something that they've necessarily researched for themselves. It's mostly opinions that are regurgitated, opinions that they picked up from someone else. And I figured, well, okay, you know, if I'm going to want to talk about this, I'm going to most probably want to educate myself on this so that I can enlighten these people on what the actual situation is rather than the assumed regurgitated opinions. And so, you know, I basically, I just, you know, locked myself in my room for years and years and years, just trying to get as much information into my head. And in 1998, I had the opportunity to create a website, and I wanted to collect all the information on the internet that was available on UFO sightings and the likes. And since that time, because of the nature of websites, people found the website and they asked me, how did they become a member of the organization? And so I didn't know what to tell them at the time, you know. And since then, I decided, well, look, this life is way too short. Time is just going past so quickly. If I'm going to be making the most of my time on this, in this short lifetime, I'm going to want to be doing what is my passion in life. And I decided that this is my passion in life, and this is where we are now, 10 years later down the line, where we are registering SAL4 as a non-profit organization in order so that we can collect information, disseminate it to those people that are interested, and educate the public as a whole.
Well, let's sort of like talk about SAL4. For starters, what's your membership like? Do you have people like all over the country? You know, you don't have to give me exact numbers, but I mean, how's it looking membership wise? And talk a little bit about some of the events that you guys have had.
Okay, now basically, since the website that I had, and you know, members from the public contacting me, there was also a situation where the media started showing interest in doing interviews, and because I put my personal contact information on my original website, you know, there was free access for anybody to contact me. And since I've been doing radio interviews, you know, a lot of people has been contacting me over the last good couple of years, I would say since about the year 2000. So it's been about 8 years now that people has been contacting me. And we've got members, about 600 people in South Africa.
Oh wow!
All different levels of membership. You know, you get your curious kind of person. It's just like, you know, wanting some information that they can't get anywhere else. And then you get people obviously who've had their own personal experiences, and then all the way up to, you know, disclosure project kind of expert witnesses as well. Mm-hmm. And then we've also even got members in other countries as well. I've got a member in Russia. I've got him in France.
Oh, wow,
and,
nice.
We've got him in Brazil. so it's very, very interesting. Yes, I've never really formalized the actual membership as such, but now with the non-profit organization registration process going through, we're going to most probably want to do that at some point as well.
Nice. And you guys have, like, monthly meeting type events and probably, like, an annual thing, right?
Yes, yes. We've been having monthly meetings for 4 years now here in Cape Town. And in August in 2005, we started meetings in Johannesburg as well, which is very far from Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And we've had three annual events, which we've decided needs to fall on World UFO Day, which is the 2nd of July. As a commemoration of the Roswell incident, and you know, the first public indication we had that we were officially being lied to.
There you go. Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of attention has been focused on that, especially because most people in the public has at some point, you know, heard about that event. Other kinds of events that we've organized are things like DVD screenings. like a movie club kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We do Skywatch evenings where we would go out and you know, just basically try and educate the people on the basic astronomy and things that are flying around at night, how to identify the different things, and in also, you know, trying to possibly establish communication with the guys that are flying around.
Now let's talk about the history of the UFO phenomenon in South Africa, because I'm sure you're pretty well versed on that. I have some dates of major cases, but the dates I have start like in the 60s, and I'm sure you know more about what was going on with the UFO phenomenon in Africa prior to that. So I guess just, you know, talk about you know, South Africa and the UFO, and how long does that history go back? Because, you know, in a lot of countries it seems to go back quite a ways. Maybe that's the case in South Africa. I don't know. That's why we have you here on the show, Chris. So let's find out. What's the history of the UFO phenomenon in South Africa?
Yeah, let's get into the meat of the history. Tim, I just want to mention at this point that part of the reason why I'm, you know, doing this organization and keeping at it is because of the fact that, as you mentioned in the beginning, you don't know much about what's happening in South Africa. You know, all the kinds of international books that we have access to in South Africa mostly talk about things that's happening in a lot in America and mm-hmm. and some other countries, but there's a distinct lack of information coming from South Africa, not because there's a lack of events. If I look back at the actual history, I can tell you that I don't know if you're aware of international waves of these, what they used to call airship sightings.
Yes.
Now, we also had a very similar wave in 1914. Mm-hmm. In the whole country, sightings of these things were seen, and there was literally not one flying machine man-made in South Africa at the time. There was not even one airstrip. Things that were seen were similar to, you know, a normal airship, like a Zeppelin, a blimp, whatever you want to call it. A lot of them had very, very strong, very strong searchlights on them. And even in those days, some very laughable official explanation were given for these sightings. Here in Cape Town, when sightings occurred, people were reporting it from a town called Worcester, which is about 130 or so kilometers from Cape Town on the other side of a mountain range. And the official explanation was that there was a naval exercise going on in Simonstown, which is very close to Cape Town, and the lights were bouncing off the clouds, you know, more than 100 kilometers. So that was very interesting and curious. And then another incident that happened in that time was a women's cricket match was played in Cape Town at a place called the Greenpoint Stadium. And this match was actually interrupted by one of these things hovering over them. So they actually cancelled the match, and everybody tried, you know, they were frantic. They didn't know what it was. The army was called in, and they tried to shoot the thing down, luckily without success.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, these kinds of things have been going on for quite a while. And as our research is ongoing, I'm sure that we will still uncover things, maybe using older language in some of the older newspaper reports and things like that. I can tell you, each time I do an interview, I give my personal contact information out over the air or in a newspaper or magazine, there's always new people contacting me with stories going back a couple of decades. Then if we look at, you know, the Project Blue Book era, that was, you know, when South Africa was still under British rule. And as far as we can tell, Britain and America was working very closely together in collating international reports. Mm-hmm. And South Africa being under the British banner at the time, you know, there was no difference in that. I've got a reference here of, let me see, 2 December 1957, where a Major R.V. Lamb of the South African Air Force Intelligence said the following: "We cannot deny the existence of unidentified objects in the sky. We have had reports of these things to which we can offer no answer." Now, that was in 1957. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since Project Blue Book closed down in 1969, you know, the whole situation changed in the public domain, where all of these kinds of official research projects, you know, went underground. And so, you know, where we are today, we're trying to piece together a puzzle to see what the actual picture was like. And then also, as our research has uncovered, there's been smaller public research groups that's always been, you know, at the scene trying to collect information and distribute it to interested people. Yes, I've basically got a list of about 10 or so such small groups that have existed at some point or another. And let me see what else I can tell you. Yes, and then you mentioned a couple of major cases as well, and I also tried to focus quite a bit on that because there has been some pretty amazing experiences reported in South Africa.
Absolutely.
Besides the 1914 airship wave, there's a bit of a gap here, which I hope that we can still fill. But in 1947, we still had a few sightings as well. But I'm going to skip to 1951, where in a town also not too far from Cape Town, about 40 kilometers from Cape Town, called Paul, there was an engineer who took his car out for a drive, one night, a test drive. He was working on the engine. And it was late at night, about 11:15 at night, very dark in the mountains. And he saw a figure standing next to the road and trying to get his attention. So he stopped and, you know, he wanted to hear what this guy was on about. And he was asked for water. And he said, yes, he knows where a nearby stream was. And he took the guy to get some water. And they filled up, you know, they took an old oil can out of the boot of his car, or the trunk, you would say, I think. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, cleaned it with some sand, and they put water in there, and they went back to the spot where he picked the guy up. And what he didn't see initially was that in a very shadowy area, there was actually a craft that was landed there. Huh. And this being, you know, seeing the generosity of this engineer, invited him on board and, you know, said he can ask any questions he wanted to. And the first thing he was interested in was to ask where they came from, and yeah. they just pointed up at the sky, not, you know, giving any specific details. Mm-hmm. And then he was quite surprised by the lack of instrumentation and such inside of the craft. Basically, all he saw was one box-like unit, and there was a panel with three levers on it. And besides that, he didn't see any kind of other buttons or steering wheels or, you know, anything mm-hmm. that we would imagine, you know, could be used as a steering mechanism for such a craft. And him being an engineer, being very fascinated by how such a thing would fly. And they told him that it works with some kind of a, you know, anti-gravity kind of situation, not going into too much detail. And you know, and then after a couple of questions, they politely said that they need to go, that their problem was, you know, sorted out, and that they would one day come back. And that was the end of their meeting. And then he was quite surprised by the whole thing, as you can imagine. And the next morning, drove to the spot, and he found actual landing marks, you know, at the spot where, wow. where it was. This case was thoroughly investigated by Cynthia Hind, I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. who was the national coordinator for MUFON. And then in 1972, we had quite a number of major things happening. There was an incident in a little town called Fort Beaufort, where multiple witnesses saw the same kind of thing. Police in a nearby town called Middleburg were the first witnesses. And basically what happened is this was over a period of 10 days to 14 days where the same object was seen in broad daylight. And on a farm called Breeside, the farmer one day actually called in the police because this thing just basically disturbed the animals on the farm and, you know, the daily activities that need to take place. And, you know, he couldn't get anything done.
Yeah.
And they actually suggested that they shoot at this thing. So they did shoot at this thing, and it was a very solid object. You could actually hear the reverberations of the bullets when it hit the thing. Mm-hmm. It changed colors just after they hit it, and it sort of made a bit of a wobble, went into the bushes, set some bushes afire, alight, and then the thing just disappeared. Now, what was interesting about this case as well from our research point of view is that we've got an organization in South Africa called the CSIR, the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. Mm-hmm. Now, soil samples were taken and sent to the CSIR to try and establish if there was anything out of the ordinary, because they could see where this thing landed at times.
Yeah.
And the soil samples actually disappeared en route to the CSIR.
Huh.
And that wasn't the first or the last time something like that happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's happening in America, what's happening in other countries, it's happening here in South Africa as well. How it's being done, how it's being coordinated, we just don't know. Then 1972 as well, a little town called Rosmead, there was another multiple witness case with traces left on the 12th of November, about 160 kilometers from the previous town where the major incident happened at Fort Beaufort. This on-duty police officers were first initial witnesses. They saw a red light just taking off into the air from Rosemead. And then while they're still watching this object, they got a call from a principal of a primary school that was there. And this was a Sunday evening. And this principal was reporting very unusual damage to the tennis courts at the school that he saw. And they weren't too surprised because they were still watching this object, you know, going into the atmosphere from that direction.
Yeah.
So they immediately investigated. And when they came to the scene, they saw very, very strange damage done to the tennis court and to nearby trees. The trees were scorched. There's also a report of a very huge rock that was no longer there. You could just see the hole that was left in the ground where this thing usually was. And why this is brought up is because it was actually a major headache for the principal, because lots of kids always played around this thing and actually got hurt because of it. And he didn't know what to do about it, and then this thing now all of a sudden just was gone. Now there's a lot of corroborating evidence supporting these reports. Lots of film footage has been taken, lots of photographs, you know, police reports, and obviously quite a number of witnesses. Mm-hmm. As well. Then in 1974, we move on to what I call the Bait Bridge incident. A couple was traveling actually from Zimbabwe, which is a neighboring country, to Durban, which is also a major city in South Africa, for a holiday. This happened on the 31st of May, and they traveled through the night, and they had two encounters with most probably the same spacecraft.
Yeah.
And they recall some details consciously, but they also to go for hypnosis, and where they recalled quite a number of other details as well. Some of the details recalled consciously was what happened was that the temperature of the car dropped dramatically while they were driving. And this was very strange. You know, they couldn't figure it out. They just piled as much blankets and extra layers of clothes onto them as they could. And as they got to one town, you know, the temperature would normalize.
Yeah.
And they wanted to throw in petrol at the gas station, and it was actually quite hot out, because it was that time of year and the area, it's not cold in that area at all, and the petrol attendant was looking at them in awe, you know, being dressed, you know, so thickly.
Yeah.
And you know, looking so cold, but it's actually so hot. So and then they also noticed, as they wanted to fill up their petrol tank, that it didn't take much petrol. Mm-hmm. Not what it was supposed to for, you know, the amount of kilometers they traveled. And this was, you know, obviously an indication that something was amiss.
Yeah.
Then as they left that town, a similar thing happened. The temperature dropped again, and you know, the radio gave some indication that there was some electromagnetic interference. And again, they don't recall much consciously, at that point. But when the investigation was done afterwards and they were regressed, by one of the top psychiatrists in South Africa at the time, specializing in that kind of regression technique, they found that the car was literally lifted off the road.
Wow.
And so this is why they didn't consume as much petrol as they were supposed to.
Yeah.
They even found that the tires that they put on just before their journey didn't show much wear at all.
Yeah.
You could still see the little, I don't know if the tires that you get there in America are the same, but we get little knobs on them when they're brand new.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
those knobs were basically still there, you know, and those things go off very quickly when you're driving on a tar road.
Mm-hmm.
And then other details that came out in the hypnosis was that there was a being that appeared in the back seat of the car. And they were taken on board the spaceship, and they underwent some medical examinations and things like that. We don't even know the names of these individuals, but all the other details are quite readily available.
Now, how come you don't know the names? Is this like a confidentiality type of thing?
Yeah, there's a. There's a major issue with, you know, you don't know who you can tell, and there's a big stigma surrounding it, where I've found, like I mentioned earlier, when I do radio interviews, you know, maybe a husband or a wife will contact me, and they would tell me a story that happened 30 years ago, and it's something they don't even feel that they can tell their spouse.
Wow.
And to me, this is another added reason for me doing the work that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, these things are real. There are things that are happening that are unexplained. We don't know why they're happening, and it's worthwhile asking the questions and doing the investigations.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's really no reason why people should react to the unknown with fear, although I know it is a natural human condition. But if we can learn to live without this natural fear reaction, you know, it opens up a whole wider horizon for us to explore things that we don't currently understand. And isn't that supposed to be really what the pursuit of science is? I mean, we don't investigate things we already know, is it?
Exactly, yeah. Now, the engineer and these people here who had the encounters, how did they describe the beings, sort of the way that they've been described across the different countries, or anything different out of the norm or anything like that?
Yes, the engineer described the beings that he encountered as very, very human-like, maybe possibly towards a Mediterranean kind of a look. They had this kind of dark hair and more of a olivey kind of skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then the beings that described in the abduction event, that was like we would know as a typical kind of a gray description.
Yeah. So the same people that we think are doing the abductions here in America cut across the boundaries.
Yes.
I don't want to jump in here, so if you want to keep going with the
Yes, I can go on for quite a while, but no, you please jump in. Yeah.
Well, let me throw a couple out that I have here, and then if there's some more that you think we should mention, I'll ask you at the end of the list I have here. I only have like four to ask you about, so.
Okay.
And they're more recent anyway. What about this 1989 UFO shootdown that apparently happened near Botswana? What's the story with that one?
One of my favorites. This is ongoing. This is open investigation still, Tim. As far as we can piece together, because obviously there's a very, very high level of secrecy surrounding this event.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the information comes from our you know, friend and researcher in Britain, Tony Dodd.
Okay.
You know, he was head of the Quest International, which is quite interesting because it looks like if you are in the country where a major event such as this happens, then you don't have access to the information. But if you're outside of the country, then you can get your hands on the information. But no, let me tell you basically as for, how we see that event. 1989, I think it was the 7th of May. Yes, the 7th of May. The first indication we had that our airspace was intruded, or was going to be intruded, was a ship called the Tafelberg, which picked up you know, the radar signals. And this was confirmed via airborne radar and land-based radar. Two Mirage jets were sent to intercept this unknown target. As far as we can tell, we were also receiving confirmation from NORAD in America.
Mm-hmm.
About this. And basically, visual contact was established by the squadron leader, whose name we do know. His surname was Huerson. And he was instructed to shoot at this object, and on this plane was mounted an experimental maser cannon. Not a laser, a maser. Microwave amplification. Hmm. I stimulated something emission. And he shot at this object once and it disabled it. There was a flash or two flashes of light seen. The object lost control and it crash landed about 40 kilometers in the Botswana side of the border. So it wasn't actually in South Africa this thing came down, which is another interesting point, because, you know, you can't just, as one country, go into another country and go pick us something up and bring it back.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. So, you know, there's a couple of interesting things that have come because of that. But what happened was the first, you know, obviously the Mirages were first on the scene. They knew the location where this thing came down. They reported it back to whoever they reported it to. And helicopters were sent to secure the area on the ground and, you know, make sure that nobody else gets close, even though it's in the desert. They know that there's, you know, nomadic people living in the area. So they just wanted to make sure that, you know, it's a clean environment, as quickly as possible, retrieve this object and get it away.
Yeah.
Sadly, what happened was that the first helicopter arrived on the scene wasn't aware of the electromagnetic field in the area, and it actually caused the instrumentation of the helicopter to malfunction, and this helicopter crashed, killing all four crew members on board.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, they had to quickly figure out a way to try and neutralize that electromagnetic field. As far as I can understand it, there was communication sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with the situation, and something like a 70-page telex was sent describing how to deal with the situation.
Oh, wow.
Basically, how they neutralized that situation is there was some kind of a paint compound that they were told to use. I don't know the exact makeup of this. Possibly at some point in the future we can, you know, get information on what exactly this thing was, mm-hmm. and see how credible that is. But they, you know, they basically painted it on by hand, and this neutralized the electromagnetic field. They were able to get these big trucks in there. This object, by the way, had a diameter of about 10 meters, about 30 foot. Mm-hmm. So they were able to load it up onto one of these flatbed trucks and in a military convoy move it to Pretoria, where most of our military headquarters are. And, you know, they do have places to hide things there.
Yeah.
As far as we can tell, it ended up at a military base called Valhalla Air Force Base. And from there, the American government was also very interested in actually acquiring this technology and the beings that was found. It eventually ended up that we gave the stuff away to you guys. And in exchange for that, America would keep quiet at the UN about our nuclear testing that was taking place.
Huh.
And I wouldn't be surprised if actual nuclear components or actual weapons was also exchanged. So the level of secrecy is very, very high. And, you know, if this story comes out with names of people who actually made these kinds of decisions, you know, heads will roll, because this hasn't been that long ago. It's only 1989. And most of the people that were involved in this incident, most probably still alive. And I've had quite a number of independent corroborations that an event actually did happen there. As you can imagine, there was quite a lot of people in the military at the time that are no longer in the military right now anymore. One guy wrote a letter to me saying that his job was to transport equipment from Pretoria to Angola at the time, which is where we had a war going. Mm-hmm. And one day, as he was driving, he passed a small convoy. There was two military vehicles at the back, and this flatbed truck in the middle, and then two military vehicles in the front, which he thought was unusual, because he regularly saw convoys like this.
Yeah.
You know, transporting equipment, captured vehicles from the Angolans, which were most probably Russian made, things that we wanted to study, you know. And this was odd, because normally there was only one vehicle behind the truck and one vehicle in front. So he paid a little bit more attention. and you could actually clearly see what was on the back of this truck because it was only covered by some kind of a tarpaulin.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was classical, like we would call a saucer shape, you know, two inverted saucers on top of each other. Mm-hmm. And he got a very good look at it because it was going very slowly and he passed them because he was going faster. And he was in a military vehicle. They were in military vehicles, so they didn't mind him, you know, catching a glance at this thing. But he mentions that it was hanging over the flatbed truck on the left-hand side where it goes into the yellow lane. We drive on the left-hand side of the road, by the way.
Yeah.
I know you guys are on the right-hand side. Mm-hmm. So now this thing was hanging over on the left-hand side over the yellow line and over the middle line on the right-hand side. And that's why they were going so slowly, because it was actually taking up a lot of road space at the time. And then I did a radio interview last year where a radar operator called in. Well, he was a radar operator at the time, and he confirmed that, you know, they call it a bogey when they pick something up on a radar, that they don't know what it is. And he picked that up himself. He was one of the people that saw that. He still says that he doesn't know what that was, but he knows something was picked up on radar. Two Mirage jets were scrambled to intercept this thing. This thing was brought down, and a major hush-up operation ensued after that. Everybody was just told to keep quiet about it, not giving any explanations.
Wow.
So, you know, these little bits and pieces are all coming together.
Where did you get the information about the being and stuff like that in the ship? I presume there was someone in the ship, so where did you get that kind of information? What do you know about that?
Yeah, the first information came from Tony Dodd. He was sent what was claimed to be official documents at the time by somebody who just copied the information from South African Air Force Intelligence, who decided that this information is way too important for it not to come out. And there was a lot of major issues regarding the personality of this guy. They eventually met with him, and, you know, because of his unreliability, a lot of doubt was cast on this whole incident, even though independent corroboration has been made by Tony Dodd and his investigators and, you know, by myself and quite a few other people as well. Mm-hmm. Now, those documents, those original documents that were sent basically gave a whole breakdown of an autopsy that was done, the exact size of the craft, and something that you would imagine, you know, a scientific study would show. It shows all the measurements, and the beings were also greys. They had three fingers. They had long claws at the end of the fingers. There were three beings found. Initially, what happened was this thing was not damaged beyond. You wouldn't notice that it was really, really damaged in the crash.
Yeah.
And they didn't know there were beings inside at the time when this craft was transported to the Valhalla Air Force Base. But when they reached there, they saw there was a little crack, and they tried to open that crack with hydraulic equipment. And you know, two beings sort of came stumbling out. They were obviously injured, and the third one was deceased. Was dead. And as far as I know, and this is typical of the South Africans, I suppose, and possibly everywhere else, is when we gave the craft and the bodies to the to you guys, we only gave you two bodies. we kept one, and there has been independent corroboration of people who was contracted to assist the military in doing an autopsy on this being at one of our world-famous hospitals in Cape Town called Groote Schuur. And the University of Cape Town was also involved in the microbiology department. And like I said, this case is still ongoing. And if possible, if you guys are interested, you know, I can keep you guys up to date as to what we find.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm fascinated by this case already. I'm excited that there may still be a body in South Africa. I think the chances are better that we'll get our hands on that than any bodies that end up in America. Well, maybe. I
certainly hope so. It's just that if we look at the situation from an objective point of view, I would imagine that the same kind of guys that are keeping a lid on it in America are the same people that's doing it here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're following the same procedures. They've got the access to the same funds and the same equipment and same specialists. So I wouldn't get my hopes up on that specifically. But I think at some point or another, the truth does come out. And as far as, you know, my personal opinion or understanding goes of, say, for instance, you know, the Majestic 12 group or the PI-40 or whatever they're called nowadays, you know, half of them or at least half of them want the public to know, you know, at least the basic details as fact. And the other half are still clinging on to the old generation of, no, you know, we can't let this out. People are going to want to look for scapegoats and, you know, I'm not going to, you know, take the blame for this.
Yeah.
So they're just, you know, leaving it for the next generation and, you know, continuing to do that. But as the newer guys are replacing the older guys, they're coming in with a different worldview. And I've got a lot of hope that the information would come straight from these guys.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. Yeah, I got two more little cases here. The Ariel School case of 1994.
Yes, yes, that was happened in Zimbabwe. Also been investigated by Cynthia Hind very thoroughly. She dedicated two chapters in her book to that one specific case.
Oh wow.
I'm not an expert on that case myself specifically. I've trying to focus my attention as far as possible on South Africa. But I can give you a bit of background on that if you like.
If you want to, if you feel comfortable, go for it.
Yeah, no, it's basically this happened at a primary school, and there was a cross-section of different cultures, and, you know, it wasn't just one, it just wasn't just white people, just black people, whatever the case may be. And what happened was this craft landed, communicated with the children while the adults, the teachers were having their break and being inside the building, and all the children are playing outside, and they received telepathic communication. And these were also grey beings, and when the investigation was done, the children were all asked to draw pictures of what they saw. Mm-hmm. And the similarities of, you know, the pictures between all these children, something like 60 children were asked to draw what they saw.
Oh, wow.
It was just amazing. As I said, mainly my focus is on South Africa, but as we, you know, get some help with the research, then obviously we will expand to neighboring countries and the rest of Africa as well.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let me ask you about what's going on kind of in the last year and a half or so down there, and that seems to be some crashes going on, some UFO crashes down there. I have one here for May of 06 and one for the end of 06, early 07. So am I correct on those dates, and is there some kind of crash wave going on?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to actually know what's going on. The 2006 one, that was in a town called Port Shepstone, and that's something that crashed into the sea, very close to the shore. But for all intents and purposes, there was a smoke trail that was seen in the air for up to about 10 minutes afterwards, and, you know, also a lot of heat as this object, whatever it was, hit the water, and, you know, the surface was bubbling and everything. So, from my point of view, I don't expect this to be anything other than either some space junk or a meteorite.
Yeah.
There was a thorough investigation done by our National Sea Rescue Institute because they received initial reports that an airplane might have gone down. So their job would be to try and, you know, find survivors or help survivors if there was such a thing. They didn't find any kind of debris, any kind of oil slick. They know exactly that they pinpoint, because of all the witnesses and the triangulation, they pinpointed the exact position, which was about 300 meters offshore, mm-hmm. where this thing came down. And they sent divers down there, and, you know, there was nothing out of the ordinary whatsoever.
Strange.
No, and then the other incident you mentioned happened in a town called Lepalale. Mm-hmm. And I don't know too much about this. This went underground as quickly as it came to the surface. Also, because it's so far away, you know, we don't have the resources yet to actually go and investigate everywhere when something happens, unfortunately. So hopefully we can get to a point like that. But as far as I remember, there was a municipality official who first publicly spoke about this. Her name was Leonie Russ, and there's no doubt of her credibility as a witness. And obviously she's not the only witness. Quite a lot of people saw a bright orange light come crashing down, and it made a heck of a loud noise, like an explosion. And then the information just becomes muddled. We really don't know what that object was. The official explanation that was given afterwards to the public is that there was a power surge along the power lines that caused this glowing ball of plasma or whatever that traveled down the transmission lines.
Strange.
Yeah, no, so hopefully we can still investigate that at some point. It's just a bit difficult being limited with resources now.
Yeah, and it seems like one of those cases where it just happened a year ago, so you're going to need to wait a little while before you get the kind of witnesses that are really key for that kind of thing, like retired military folks and stuff. And what about any other key or notable cases you want to mention? Anything you think that we left out that you think is, you know, a hallmark of South African ufology that we didn't hit on?
Yes, there's been quite a few other ones. I'm just going to briefly touch on them, and I can also make a synopsis of it, maybe make it available for you to put on your website at some point. Let me see here. Yes, in 1975, in a town called Loxton, there was another landing that happened. Let me see the kind of trace evidence that was left on that spot. Nothing ever grew ever again up until this day.
Huh.
So that's quite another heavy one there, with physical evidence. And in 1978, there's a Groendal Nature Reserve in a town called Port Elizabeth, where four teenage boys went out hiking, and they saw a landed craft, and they saw silver-suited beings, which didn't walk like humans. They sort of floated more than they walked.
Mm-hmm.
And the terrain was quite inaccessible as well, where these beings were moving. And when they were moving uphill, instead of leaning forward like we would, if you can imagine just trying to walk uphill, you always lean a little bit forward.
Yeah.
And if it's extremely uphill, you lean a lot forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these guys were just walking at a 90-degree angle, or floating at a 90-degree angle uphill.
Weird.
And one of these guys was carrying a silver suitcase. It was very clear. All the descriptions are the same. And from my personal information, I came across this case because I met a guy who was at school with these four teenagers at the time. And he told me that guys claiming to be from NASA came to them and, did a bit of an interview and did hypnosis on these four teenage boys. And after the hypnosis session, they would not talk about the event ever again. So I don't know what happened there. We do know this. It was investigated by the University of Port Elizabeth. A geology professor there brought some Geiger counters with, and they used experienced bush trackers who works on the nature reserve, knows the area very well, to try and find the spot. And they did find the spot. They took measurements. There were symmetrical marks left there, and it was a really, really inaccessible bush terrain.
Yeah.
It's not something that somebody could quite easily hoax.
Mm-hmm.
And then to continue, we had another major case happen in 1979. We call this the Mindelaw case. A mom and her son took the dog for a walk one evening, and in the middle of the road, there was this craft parked, and then the mom said to the boy, run back and go get your dad, and that's all they remember. And then they also went for hypnosis, and then basically they were invited on board, but they didn't want to really go on board, and there were some medical experiments done on them, and unfortunately a little boy also died in a car accident not long after that, and the mom also didn't really want to talk about it any much more after that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got another crash similar to the Kalahari incident of 1989 in 1995 in Lesotho, which is a neighboring country inside of the borders of South Africa. Also very, very scant details. On the 15th of September, a farmer in the area basically notified the police that that something crashed on his farm and all his grasslands were, you know, aflame. And he said to them, whatever it is, come and take it away. You know, that's all he wanted, was worried about.
Yeah.
And so this went up the chain, got to our Air Force, and, you know, and the rest we don't know anything about. And then in 1996, there's another major case where literally hundreds of police officers were involved. Very early hours of the morning, a very bright object was seen hovering over a distance of about 160 kilometers. This thing was tracked and traced and chased by police officers. Even in a helicopter, and they took some video footage of the object, and the eventual explanation was that this thing was Venus, which doesn't really inspire much confidence in our police force if that is the case.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I also did receive some information which could possibly point to this not being an actual UFO but an IFO. I'm still trying to get corroboration of this, but it is quite possible that this was a top secret radar reflector device connected to a balloon, which at the time they couldn't reveal because it was being used in secrecy at the time for national defense purposes, and that I do understand. But you know, since then, you know, if the information is not sensitive anymore, so it is able to come out. Like I said, I'm just trying to still get you know, some written confirmation.
Yes.
But it does fit the all the details. And in 1998, in a town called Graaf Reinet, 3 p.m. on the 27th of December, another UFO incident was captured on video. This time, multiple rounded triangular craft were seen, which seemed to move in a formation. While this group was performing aerial maneuvers, a much larger spherical object flew by, and the other objects seemed to follow it until the whole group disappeared behind the clouds. So as you can hear, you know, we've got the whole range of things happening here as well.
Yeah.
And then I'd just like to touch briefly on a few of the personalities, people who've had ongoing contacts or has talked a bit about some information on an ongoing basis.
Like contactees in South Africa?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Yeah, let's hear it. That sounds fascinating.
Well, the most famous contactee from South Africa is a woman called Elizabeth Clara. Her contacts began in 1956, she wrote a book about experiences called Beyond the Light Barrier. There's also quite a bit of information on her and her story on the internet. So, you know, if anybody wants to go check up on this, there's a lot of information, you know, that came from her. A lot of very interesting scientific information as well. Mm-hmm. On, you know, as the title of her book indicates, Beyond the Light Barrier. You know, when we do interviews as UFO researchers, and we always get this, you know, kind of a left brain logical scientific question as to, you know, how do they travel faster than the speed of light, because otherwise it just would take so long.
Yeah.
And obviously that's just a very limited way of looking at traveling through space and time. As we know, we can actually bend space and time, so that's not really a relevant question. But anyway, she also ended up working for the South African Air Force Intelligence, according to her own claims, to assist with the identification of unidentified flying objects. So I've not yet been able to independently corroborate this claim, but hopefully with the use of, you see, we've got something similar to the Freedom of Information Act that you guys got there in America.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Promotion of Access to Information Act here in South Africa, and I'm hoping to use that to establish, you know, some of the details that she's claimed. And what I can add to this is that a lot of information was withheld out of her first book. She was told basically not to talk about this, and we're still waiting for this information to be released in a second book called The Gravity File. And we don't understand why this information is not coming out. It's quite a headache, actually. We want this information to come out because there's such a rarity of published books in South Africa on South African events. So we, as an organization, hopefully we can assist in the process of actually getting that book published.
And when you said she was told to hold the information back, was she told by the South African Air Force she worked for, or the beings, if you will?
The Department of Defense of South Africa, yeah.
Interesting.
As far as we can tell, the gravity file talks about how the anti-gravity kind of propulsion systems work. And it mentions dates and places and names of, of people who don't want that kind of details revealed.
Yeah.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?